From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Sony Music is cutting ties with controversial R&B artist R. Kelly. What was the final straw? Then a New Yorker journalist on how television producer Mark Burnett and his reality show The Apprentice turned Donald Trump into a TV star and a viable candidate for president.
As I tracked down these people who worked on those early seasons of the show, they all told me, we reinvented him on screen.
And actress Isabella Rossellini has become the ringleader of her own circus. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. On January 3rd, Lifetime premiered the documentary series Surviving R. Kelly, and it included women who recounted their alleged experiences of being abused by the R&B singer. Many of those stories were not new, but taken as a whole, they were striking. R. Kelly has never been convicted of a crime, but the accounts of his alleged abuse have been public for decades, and the fact that he'd gone largely unpunished and kept making records led to a social media campaign called Mute R. Kelly, and there was pressure on his label, RCA, to drop him. Today, that happened, with reports that Sony Music, RCA's parent company, is cutting ties with Kelly. To find out what prompted this move, I spoke with Jem Aswad. He's senior music editor for Variety.
I'll start by saying R. Kelly has not been convicted of any crime. Having said that, as the recent series Surviving R. Kelly showed, multiple women accuse him of sexual misconduct. And frankly, it's appalling sexual misconduct. These allegations date back to the mid-1990s. He was prosecuted on child pornography charges beginning, I think the trial began in 2001. But, you know, there was a sex tape that purportedly featured him with an underage girl performing sexual acts. That the girl in the video declined to testify, so he was acquitted 5 years after the trial began. More accusations bubbled up last summer. I think the term was sex cult, that women were essentially being brainwashed and he was holding them in homes that he owns, and they weren't being allowed to go to the bathroom without his permission. They had to call him daddy. Food would be withheld from them. Again, none of this, he has not been convicted of any crimes, but all you have to do is watch Surviving R. Kelly and you're seeing extensive accusations of this kind of behavior.
So there's not only the Lifetime series, but very recently, a manager for R. Kelly turned himself in Georgia on charges that he had threatened a man who had accused the R&B singer of holding his daughter captive. Do you think those two things accelerated this?
Things reached, again, you know, what's surprising to me is that it took a documentary, I mean, albeit a very hard-hitting and very upsetting documentary, to bring all of this to light. Because there was new testimony in that documentary, and, you know, there may have been some new accusations, but there was very little new information. But combine that with Me Too, combine that with the culture that we're in at the moment, combine that with the government we have at the moment, and the situation became untenable. The situation had been untenable, frankly, for quite some time. But as Spotify discovered last year, you might remember that Spotify tried to institute a policy against hateful conduct that would have banned R. Kelly from its playlist. Now, his music still would have been available on the platform for anyone who wanted to listen to it, but it wasn't going to be featured in the playlist. Now, they didn't define that policy very well, so people were able to say, well, look, R. Kelly hasn't been convicted of anything. Do you have convicted felons on your roster? And I assume they did. Are you going to drop them too? And eventually they had to walk back the policy. So it's a very... The fact that R. Kelly has not been convicted of anything makes this very difficult to enforce on moral grounds.
We did something about the Lifetime documentary series recently, and we got a response from a listener who tweeted us saying that part of the reason that he was allegedly able to get away with what he was purported to be doing for so long is that the victims, or the purported victims, were Black girls and Black women. Do you think race has been in any way a part of this conversation?
Yes, Absolutely, 1,000%, unquestionably. And as they say in the documentary, and as they say in many of the articles that have been written about this for the last 25 years, if these things had happened to white women, he would have been in jail a long time ago.
How much do you think public activism and social media had to do, at least in making RCA make a decision? The hashtag Mute R. Kelly has been trending on social media. Somebody flew a plane over the record label with a banner saying, drop R. Kelly. Do you think that factored into the conversation or the pressure that was on the label?
It definitely factored in. I wouldn't say that any of those things were decisive, but all of those things contributed. I would note that at the very beginning of this year, I think it was on January 3rd, RCA did announce that it had signed a new deal with Chris Brown, which, you know, I mean, Chris Brown has served his time. Okay.
He beat up Rihanna. I mean, he physically beat up somebody.
But as I said, he served his time for that. So, you know, I mean, again, and I'm not placing any value judgment on this whatsoever. I think that is, you know, completely inexcusable and horrible. But he did serve his legal time for it. You know, but again, it comes down to optics. You know, I mean, for RCA to do that when the R. Kelly controversy was heating up again was a fairly questionable move.
Let me ask you this last question. R. Kelly, if he does sever from RCA, still has some music he can still play, right? I mean, can he still have a career even if this label has dropped him?
Yeah, yes, he can. He has a very dedicated fan base. The only way that it's really affected him business-wise is in his touring, and that is a very lucrative business, obviously, and he's had to cancel a lot of concerts, but it's entirely conceivable that he can release music independently because all he has to do is put it up on SoundCloud or YouTube or somewhere like that, or he could find a smaller independent label to distribute his recordings. So is his career dead? No. His career was flagging a bit, to be honest with you. You know, he last had a big hit 12 years ago, I would say. But that's not to say that he has not still been making money, because he has.
Jem Aswad is senior music editor for Variety. He joined us by phone from his office in New York. Jem, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, The New Yorker writer Patrick Rodden Keefe on how The Apprentice creator Mark Burnett turned Donald Trump into a TV star.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. There's been a fair amount of discussion about Donald Trump as the first reality TV president. But what about the man who actually made the reality TV show that helped reinvent Trump? British television producer Mark Burnett is the creator of The Apprentice. Before that, he produced the American version of Survivor, and since then, shows like The Voice and Shark Tank. Patrick Radden Keefe, a staff writer for The New Yorker, recently profiled Burnett for the magazine. He did not interview Burnett himself. In recent years, Burnett has declined to talk about The Apprentice or Donald Trump. But Keefe did speak with many of Burnett's friends, colleagues, former wives, and several former producers and editors of The Apprentice. When I reached Keefe by Skype today, he explained Burnett's relationship with Donald Trump.
Burnett has said that Trump is his soulmate. He said that his relationship with Trump has been one of the most kind of cherished and important relationships of his life. And on the one hand, they're very different. Burnett is entirely self-made. He came from a working-class family in East London, you know, whereas Trump dodged the draft. Burnett went off and joined the parachute regiment in the British Army. But in another way, they're very, very similar, which is that they both, I think, see the world in pretty dog-eat-dog terms. I think they share a view that life is a contest and that it's all about winning. And I think they have another thing in common, which is that they both seem to believe that Americans are fundamentally gullible about certain things. There's a kind of lowest common denominator aspect to American culture, and yet they're both really enthusiastic about selling things to those people. So there's a quote that I found from an event that Burnett did with Trump years ago, in which Burnett said, you know, the thing about Americans is there's a few things that they'll pay for. They'll pay to grow hair, they'll pay to have sex, and they'll pay to have somebody teach them how to be rich. And that's how he explained his motivation for doing The Apprentice with Donald Trump.
One of the things that I think is most fascinating about the reporting that you did is the way that Donald Trump was seen before and then after The Apprentice. I want to read you a quote from one of the show's producers, Jonathan Braun. Most of us knew he was a fake. He had just gone through I don't know how many bankruptcies, but we made him out to be the most important person in the world. What did that mean to them and the way that they put the show together? And then how quickly did that start to change the way that he was viewed?
As I tracked down these people who worked on those early seasons of the show, they all told me we reinvented him on screen. The idea was we were going to take this guy who had all these bankruptcies, he was kind of a failure, and we were going to make him out to be this total master of the universe. And they sort of needed to do that because that was the only way that plausibly you could build this show in which you have all these people who were pretty impressive, the early candidates, and that you would believe that these candidates wanted to come and, you know, give up their job at Goldman Sachs to try their best to become a protege to Donald Trump. And the way they did that on the show took a number of forms, but they would always do these very dramatic entrances. A lot of the time, if you watch those early seasons, Trump is forever, seems to be riding around in helicopters or kind of climbing in and out of limousines. And there's a huge amount of stuff done at Trump Tower with him coming down the escalator and this kind of tense music and this idea that he's really this great potentate who comes in. And they made him out to have kind of impeccable judgment. And what was surprising to me in talking to all the people who worked on the show is that they did all this in editing.
Mr. Trump,
why wouldn't you let him go? Let me ask you this, Michael. He's killing her. He's going after her. She should be fired, according to him. And you're trying to stop him from talking.
Because, Mr. Trump, I was...
Hey, look, you claim to be like me. The difference is I work hard.
You've been lazy. You've been nothing but trouble. And now you cut them off as they're fighting each other for who should be fired. Michael,
yes.
Michael.
Yes, sir.
You're fired.
And one of the things that is obvious is a lot of things that Donald Trump and the people who worked with and around him noticed is that there was something about The Apprentice that they could borrow. So what did he take away from The Apprentice in the way that he wanted to cast himself and shoot himself and present himself in the world?
Well, Trump has always loved the experience of The Apprentice. The show really did reinvent him. His obsession with ratings goes back to the early days of The Apprentice when he would follow the ratings of the show really closely. And there's a philosophy that some people who were involved in that show have, which is that part of the reason he ran for president was that he was trying to kind of recapture that magic. So The Apprentice was still on at the point where he announced, or it was, you know, there, he conceivably could have come back for another season. But by that point, the ratings were quite bad. It had become The Celebrity Apprentice. And what Trump did was he filmed the actual announcement when he announces that he's going to run for president. The entrance that he makes is in the lobby of Trump Tower, coming down the escalator, just as they did many, many times on The Apprentice.
Wow. Whoa. That is some group of people, thousands. So nice. Thank you very much. That's really nice. Thank you.
In fact, it's a funny detail, but there were a lot of people there that day when he made the announcement, clapping and applauding. They're all lined up around the lobby. And it turns out they were all day players that you would hire, you know, to be in a TV show. They got paid $50 a pop to go there and applaud. But it's not just that. Trump recently has started doing these video addresses outside the West Wing. So he'll have these videos that he'll release on Twitter where you see him looking right into the camera. He's in the Rose Garden. And he's been known to actually tell camera people who film him, what he says is, shoot me like they shot me on The Apprentice.
There are so many people in Hollywood who are attracted to wealth and success. And at the same time, a lot of those people are no fans of Donald Trump. So there's a turning point in the town's relationship with Mark Burnett, and it seems to change Mark Burnett's relationship to the media, and it happens at the 2016 Emmys. What happens there?
So at the 2016 Emmys, Jimmy Kimmel was the host. And at this point, the election is coming up, but it hasn't happened yet. So Donald Trump was the Republican candidate at that stage. And during Kimmel's monologue, he suddenly gets into this digression where he says, he's talking about TV, and he says, you know, TV is great because it brings people together, but it can also split us apart.
Many have asked, who is to blame for Donald Trump, the Donald Trump phenomenon? And I'll tell you who, because he's sitting right there. That's right, that guy.
And the live feed at this point cuts to Mark Burnett, who has this sort of awkward, frozen grin on his face.
I'm going on the record right now. He's responsible. If Donald Trump gets elected and he builds that wall, the first person we're throwing over it is Mark Burnett. The tribe has spoken.
It was an interesting moment because it happens in this very public way. And after that encounter, Mark Burnett stopped going to awards shows, by and large.
I want to mention a number to you. 60,000 hours, and that is a specific figure about how many hours of outtakes there might be from The Apprentice. And there's a couple of questions. One is, what does Donald Trump say or not say in all of those outtakes? And the second question is, who controls those outtakes? Where are they physically, and might they ever see the light of day?
The footage is now controlled by MGM, where Mark Burnett is the chairman of television. MGM acquired Mark Burnett's company, and in so doing, they acquired this archive. So the archive, I believe, is in a number of different locations, and the footage is in different formats, but it's all controlled by MGM. And MGM says legally they cannot release any of this material for a variety of reasons.
Well, they could. They would get sued, but it's nothing criminal. It'd be a civil complaint, but it's not like they would be thrown in jail.
Yes. I mean, I think that the reality, though, is they don't intend to release anything. Burnett doesn't intend to release anything. So the only way that this stuff would come out would be if somebody leaked it. The second question that is important here and interesting is, you know, what kind of material would be in those outtakes? I talked to enough people who worked on the show to become pretty persuaded that there's a lot of Trump saying pretty inappropriate things to and about women. Anything that rises to the level that you got with the Access Hollywood tape, I don't know. I mean, this is one of the tricky things with Trump, is that he sets the bar so high in terms of inappropriate behavior that, you know, anything that doesn't match it comes to seem positively harmless. You know, as for the racial slurs, this was an interesting one. I kind of went into this believing that probably there were tapes of him, for instance, using the N-word, which has been widely rumored. But I spoke to enough people who worked on the show who really don't like Trump, but also don't believe that such a tape exists, that I came out believing that probably it doesn't.
Tony Schwartz, who ghostwrote Donald Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, has come to say that he regrets working on the book and what it did to enable and empower Donald Trump. Even if people who worked on The Apprentice didn't vote for Donald Trump, they were trying to make a successful show, and it was a successful show for a while. Do they regret what they did on the show?
I talked to any number of people who said that they toss it and turn at night and feel some shame about the sense of complicity that they feel in having put a man into the White House who, in most instances, they believe really, you know, shouldn't be there. The really interesting thing about this story, right, is that the one person who seems pretty untroubled by his kind of authorship in this whole episode is Mark Burnett.
Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is the author of the article, How Mark Burnett Resurrected Donald Trump as an Icon of American Success. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Isabella Rossellini has run off and joined the circus. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Isabella Rossellini is famous for many things, for being the daughter of Ingrid Bergman and filmmaker Roberto Rossellini, for her career as a glamorous model, and for her riveting role in one of David Lynch's creepier movies. But lately, she's been writing and performing short films and stage shows that focus on her fascination with the animal kingdom. Rossellini recently met with Frame contributor Chloe Veltman at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. It's where they chatted about training dogs, breeding chickens, and making theater as exotic birds and butterflies fluttered above.
Get out of there! Get out! Put your hands up on your head! Do it!
That's Isabella Rossellini in an intense scene from the 1986 thriller Blue Velvet. These days, the actor's wild animal instincts are coming out in a very different way.
Isn't it wonderful that the big bad wolf was taken out of you and now you are just a little nice doggy?
That's Rossellini and her dog, Pan. They're coming to LA later this month with Link Link Circus, a stage show all about animal behaviour. The tour also had a stop in San Francisco, and it seemed like the California Academy of Sciences was a perfect place for us to meet.
Look how many different colours they have. These butterflies are amazing.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, you put some oranges there to attract them, see? They come to the dish.
Do you think a creature like that has emotions, has thoughts?
I don't know. You know, I mean, butterflies are so far from us, no? They're not mammalians, they don't even have a backbone, they don't have a spine, so it's harder. But when it comes to animals that are closer to us, apes, chimpanzee, gorilla, one can imagine that we share a lot in common. Yeah.
It's a little surreal to be strolling around the Cal Academy's four-story replica of a tropical rainforest on a cold, wet Monday evening with this Hollywood icon. Rossellini's just flown in from Seattle. Even though she's tired from all the travel, she still exudes elegance and an impish sense of humour. She tells me she's been interested in the animal kingdom since she was a little girl. So I ask her about her childhood pets.
Well, my parents always had dogs and cats, so I think their first connections were the pet at home. But we are a family of animal lovers. There was a photo of the family recently, and we are five people, and we were photographed with our dogs, and we were six dogs. The dogs outnumbered us.
You went back to school to get a master's degree in animal behaviour. What's one of the most surprising things you've learned about the relationship between animals and humans in the course of your studies?
I found out things that were fascinating. The process of domestication, it was unclear to me. It's still unclear, but of course, a wolf became the dog, a buffalo became the cow, a wild fowl became domestic chickens, and how our ancestors, without even understanding evolution, were able to create animals that were useful to themselves. That, to me, is a fascinating process.
Link Link Circus builds on a series of films and performances you created about the mating and parenting habits of various animals, spiders, hamsters, bees, and so on. Why did you decide to parlay your academic pursuits into theatrical ones?
So as an actress, I also did a lot of independent films. So I was associated with Sundance, and they asked me, would you like to make a series of 2 minute film? But if it is about the environment, because Robert Redford is such a great environmentalist, we will be more inclined to finance it. And at first I said, well, I don't know what to do. And then, boom, I said, oh, we could do the mating ritual of animals. It could be very simple. So I say, if I were a fly, I become a fly. I will mate this way. If I were an earthworm, I transform myself in an earthworm. I'll mate that way. They ordered the series, and it was very successful. It really opened up a whole new career for me in my 60s.
What makes this latest show different from your previous animal-focused productions?
This one is made a little bit like a circus. There is also a little doggy.
Tell us, please, about what she'll be doing on stage.
She does dress up as different animals. Bee, a dinosaur, a sheep, a lion, a chicken.
Does she make the noises of the chickens and the lions?
No, she barks.
Do you ever feel like she steals the limelight from you?
Oh, yeah, she does, definitely. Everybody, they want to meet her at the end. Everybody comes with treats, no more flowers for me.
So, you recently started raising chickens, I read, at your Long Island farm, and you even wrote a book about it. What do you learn from hanging out with your chickens?
We're trying to bring back, instead of the industrial chicken, heritage breeds. They are healthier animals. They are able to raise their baby naturally. So I think it's important not only to conserve for nostalgia of the past, but because it's very important to keep the biodiversity.
How do people react when they hear Isabella Rossellini, you know, movie star, model, muse to Martin Scorsese and David Lynch, has written a book about chicken farming and is touring around the country with her dog in a circus? I mean, it's all so different, Isabella. So I want to know a little more about how your latest activities are being perceived.
Sometimes I see that people might have just known me as a model, and so they imagine that, you know, I wear a lot of makeup and I only talk about facial. And so when they say, well, you're a farmer, I didn't expect that. But I just do what is interesting to me. And there are many things that are interesting to me, from cosmetics to animals.
That was Frame contributor Chloe Veltman chatting with Isabella Rossellini at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. Rossellini's show, Link Link Circus, plays the Broad Stage in Santa Monica from January 25th to the 27th. And that is it for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We have a special encore edition of The Frame for MLK Day. Join us then.